Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 19th, on Iris. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. Windy again for Friday, frosty starts likely this weekend. While we're expecting some drier weather this weekend, it doesn't mean there won't be some wrinkles to watch out for in our forecast. It's a very chilly start to the day for Friday, with temperatures in the low to mid-30s for most of us. The far southern counties in the area may be the only ones to escape at least patchy frost early on, thanks to the clearer skies and lighter winds that developed overnight. With full sunshine to start the day, temperatures should start to recover pretty steadily, and we'll be back into the mid to upper 50s by the afternoon. This still falls at least a few degrees short of normal highs for this stage in April. The daytime hours also come with stronger winds once again. Once the sun comes up, winds will steadily increase, reaching the 15 to 25 mile per hour range for sustained winds and 30 to 40 mile per hour for gusts. The peak of those occurs this afternoon and early evening, though winds should again turn lighter tonight after sunset. With clearer skies and lighter winds at night both tonight and tomorrow night, the chance for temperatures to fall into a range that could easily promote frost development looks likely. The coldest part of an air mass from Canada will be heading into the upper Midwest, centered on the area around the Great Lakes. While we won't be in the core of that air mass, we'll still be plenty affected by it, and temperatures remain cool throughout the weekend. Expect lows tonight and tomorrow night to dip into the low 30s for most, with even a few upper 20s possible in favored locations like low-lying areas. We won't be out of the woods for frosty conditions on Sunday night into Monday morning, though the temperature trend will be heading in the opposite direction by then. Since we've had warmer conditions so far for most of the year, some plants and flowers may be a bit ahead of schedule in terms of growth. If you have plants that are sensitive to such cold temperatures, make sure to either bring them indoors at night or cover them up. The good news outside of the frost potential is that the weekend should be pretty decent, if you can tolerate the below normal temperatures. A decent amount of cloud development is possible on Saturday, with an isolated sprinkle not totally ruled out in a few spots. Highs should be at their coolest to start the weekend, with temperatures in the upper 40s to low 50s. Breezy conditions are likely to develop during the day again, adding a little extra chill at times. Sunday may be the winner of the weekend, weather-wise, with lots of sunshine and lighter winds than Saturday. Temperatures will also be on their way back upward as the chillier air mass begins to move away, with readings back in the mid to upper 50s again likely. Conditions stay pretty quiet for a good portion of Monday, but clouds will increase through the day. Temperatures should still be able to reach the upper 50s to mid 60s. Eventually, a storm system that shares some similarities with the one that gave us rain yesterday moves into the region Monday, bringing shower chances back. This holds off until later on Monday, lasting through at least parts of Tuesday, when a cold front moves through. At this time, it appears this system brings mainly plain rain, as we saw with the last one. A few rumbles of thunder can't be ruled out, though the risk for severe weather is extremely low. A couple of tenths of an inch of rainfall is likely during this time period. Behind the early week storm system, we see a bit of a break with quieter weather possible for the middle of the week. Our warming trend will be put on hold for a bit, with daytime highs reaching the mid-50s to around 60. Overnight lows will turn colder by a little bit, with readings back in the 30s. At this time, the frost potential here looks lower than this weekend, but we'll be watching for any changes that could push through those lows even lower. Late next week, at least one storm system will affect the region, giving us a shot at some showers and then some storms. This will be another time period to watch, especially toward the weekend, when some stronger storms could form if things line up right. A decent amount of rainfall could also take place, again, if things line up. Now, turning to the front page of the Courier, we have two stories to read today. The first is titled, Lawmakers Mull Pay Raise. Salary boost could attract greater cross-section of Iowans to serve. Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau wrote this story. Dateline Des Moines. Looking to make service in the Iowa legislature more accessible, state lawmakers are moving a bill that would raise their own salary and the salary of statewide elected officials. The bill comes after several retiring lawmakers said during speeches this year that the pay should be increased to allow Iowans with a less reliable income outside the legislature to run for seats. If signed into law, House Study Bill 750 would give members of the legislature a 40% pay raise, increasing their annual salary from $25,000 a year to $35,000 starting in 2025 after the next general election. The pay would increase each year to keep up with the cost of living. The Iowa House Appropriations Committee passed the bill on a vote of 17-8 on Wednesday. It must pass the House and Senate and be approved by Governor Kim Reynolds to become law. Why do lawmakers want to increase their pay? Representative Gary Moore, a Republican from Bettendorf, who introduced the bill, said the legislative pay needs to be enough to attract a more representative cross-section of Iowans. Quote, if we truly want to attract a quality of people to be in the legislature that's cross-representative of Iowans, that's what we want. I think we need to raise that salary, he said. Multiple lawmakers suggested raising the salary as they've given their retirement speeches in the final weeks of the session. Representative Phil Thompson, a Republican from Boone, a 33-year-old who was first elected to the Iowa House in 2018, said during his retirement speech this month that he and his wife are expecting their first child this year, and financial needs are the main reason he opted not to run for a fourth term. Quote, it was a fun run, but honestly, we just can't afford to do another round of it with our first kiddo on the way, he said. As rewarding as this work is, it really just isn't cut out for working-age families. You guys should fix that if you really want a representative government, unquote. The state legislature skews much older than the general Iowa population. The average age of current members of the legislature is 55, according to figures provided by legislative staff last year. Iowa's median age is around 38. The legislature generally meets from January through the end of April each year, and lawmakers hold intermittent meetings in their district and Des Moines in the interim. Farmers, small business owners, lawyers, and other professionals with more flexible schedules make up a significant portion of the legislature. Several lawmakers are retired. Members of the Iowa legislature have been paid $25,000 a year since 2005, and some leaders make up to $37,000. Before the last increase, lawmakers' pay had been $21,120 since 1997. In addition to their salary, lawmakers receive a per diem allowance for food and lodging that amounts to $178 a day for those outside Polk County and $133.50 for those in Polk County. The per diem is paid for 110 days in the first session after a general election and 100 days in the second. Lawmakers also can receive a per diem if they travel to Des Moines for meetings when the legislature is not in session. Members of the legislature also receive retirement benefits through the Iowa Public Employee Retirement System and have the option to receive health insurance through the state. Who else will get a pay raise? The bill would also boost the pay for legislative leaders and the governor, attorney general, and other statewide elected officials, all by $10,000. Under the changes, the House Speaker, Senate President, and majority and minority floor leaders would make $47,000, while the Speaker pro tem and the Senate President pro tem would make $37,000. The governor's salary would be bumped up to $140,000, while the attorney general would be paid $133,669. The lieutenant governor, secretary of state, state auditor, state treasurer, and secretary of agriculture would all be paid $113,212. Starting in 2026, the pay of lawmakers and other state officials would be adjusted each year to keep up with inflation. Also on Wednesday, the committee unanimously passed House Study Bill 749, which directs the Legislative Council, a committee made up of House and Senate leadership, to establish pay increases for legislative staff after the session ends. The pay scale for those employees is set by the council rather than by law. Quote, "I do know that we're struggling to hire and retain staff in these positions, and in order to be competitive with other salaries in other parts of government, I believe we must look at this and move this bill forward as well," said Representative Joel Fry, who is a Republican from Osceola, during a subcommittee on Tuesday. Bill adding civics social studies requirements heads to Reynolds. Story written by Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. The story begins with a photograph taken on the inside of a classroom of an elementary school, and the room is empty except for the furniture. Dateline, Des Moines. A bill requiring Iowa schools to adopt new social studies and civics education standards with a focus on Western civilization, U.S. and Iowa history, and, quote, "civic virtues displayed in the lives of exemplary Americans," unquote, is headed to Governor Kim Reynolds to be signed into law. House lawmakers on Wednesday passed an amended bill that calls for the Iowa Department of Education director to conduct a review of school curriculum, education standards, and high school graduation rates, and give recommendations to the governor and legislature. Senate Republicans amended House File 2545 by inserting similar provisions included in a separate bill that passed the House in February, but stalled in the Senate and failed to pass a legislative funnel deadline needed to advance. House Republicans concurred with the Senate amendment and passed the bill on a vote of 57-36, and it was a party-line vote, with all Democrats opposed. The bill now heads to Reynolds for her signature. The original House bill would have required schools to teach a list of social studies concepts developed by a conservative think tank that focuses on the, quote, "cultural heritage of Western civilization and the United States' exceptional and praiseworthy history," unquote. The amendment passed by the Republican-controlled Iowa Senate includes language from House File 2544, which would have mandated Iowa K-12 schools to teach students about the structure of the U.S. government, the rights and responsibilities of U.S. citizens, and a range of concepts, people, and events in U.S. history, including the flag and the national anthem, the country's founding documents, and, quote, "admirable Americans," including Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, Frederick Douglass, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Abraham Lincoln. The language in the bill was modeled by the Civics Alliance, an offshoot of the conservative nonprofit education advocacy organization, National Association of Scholars. The group advocates for a curriculum designed to emphasize conservative values, Western civilization, and capitalism in civics education, and push out instruction on critical race theory, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and social justice. What should be taught? The Senate amendment includes similar provisions requiring that exemplary figures and important events from Western civilization and U.S. and Iowa history are covered, as well as federal and Republican form of government in comparison to alternative forms of government, and the crimes against humanity that have occurred under communist regimes since 1917, unquote. It also would require history standards include the teaching of secular and religious ideals and institutions of liberty, including political, religious, economic, social, and cultural liberty in Western civilization, the United States, and the state of Iowa, unquote. The bill directs the Iowa Board of Education to conduct a review and revision of the state's social studies standards to include these subjects for students in grades 1 through 12 in a relevant and age-appropriate manner. These standards would be adopted by December 31st of 2025. Republicans said the bill was necessary to teach Iowa students about the high points of American history and the achievements of the country's major historical figures, asserting students have a lack of understanding and appreciation of the nation's founding principles and address declining patriotism. Quote, "We cannot and will not let our great American experiment fail," said Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison. "And one of the ways we can do that is to ensure that our children are taught the blessings of liberty. I think it is past time to emphasize to our American children the character and founding values that built this country," unquote. Others pointed to movements to take down statues of historical Americans, including Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was a slaveholder, the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, and the third president of the United States. Quote, "Yes, he did bad things," said Representative Schuyler Wheeler, a Republican from Hull and chair of the House Education Committee. Quote, "But yes, there were things that he did that I don't believe are always represented fairly. If you're going to teach the history, you teach everything," unquote. Democrats in the Senate argued the bill was overly prescriptive of schools and ignores essential aspects of U.S. history like slavery, the Jim Crow South, and civil rights movement, Native American treatment, and other historical injustices. The bill does not require general instruction on the history of slavery in the U.S., but it does call for instruction on the Emancipation Proclamation. Quote, "This legislature has never put curriculum in the code, and it's not the job of the legislature to prescribe curriculum," said Senator Molly Donahue, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, who has worked for 33 years as a special education teacher. Quote, "Prescribing curriculum would limit teachers' time and resources," Donahue said. "It's not age-appropriate or grade-appropriate, and it's sourced from an out-of-state conservative group called Civics Alliance, without proper input from Iowa educators, parents, and school boards," unquote. By limiting curriculum to focus on Western civilization, Donahue worried schools would forego instruction on all other cultural and historic figures throughout world history. She asserted the bill amounts to indoctrination, quote, "based on Christian nationalist ideas, focused on whitewashing history," unquote. Senator Herman Quambach, a Democrat from Ames, offered an amendment that would have changed references to Western civilization, to world civilization, stressing Quambach the need for inclusive curriculum and a global education that understands and values diverse cultures and world economics beyond Western civilization. Wheeler, the Hull Republican and the bill's floor manager, said the bill does not prohibit schools from teaching about non-Western civilizations or other pieces of world history. Quote, "I am excited about the opportunity to review our standards and include things I was never taught in school, such as the Korean War, things that some of our kids today are not being taught, such as the war on terrorism, he said. Quote, we are not writing curriculum. We're simply saying you're going to do a comprehensive review of our standard, which we haven't done. You can't argue that this is prescriptive, and you certainly can't argue that this is political, unquote. Senator Sandy Salmon, a Republican from Janesville, said lawmakers are not saying students should not learn about other civilizations. Quote, but they better understand what our heritage is, where we come from, so that they will be able to understand where we need to go, unquote. Senator Jeff Taylor, a Republican from Sioux Center, called Democrats' criticisms grossly unfair. He said the focus on Western civilization is important because it is the foundational context of both American history and current culture, from its form of governance to the use of the English language. Taylor said the broad language in the bill also allows schools to teach a range of concepts, people, and events in U.S. history, and are, quote, not ignoring the contributions of people who are Asian American and African American or Latin American, unquote. Wheeler added, quote, we want our students well educated, and if you're in America, you need to know our history and our heritage. You need to know Western civilization. They're going to teach the good, the bad, and the ugly. They're going to teach from an ancient Israel to 2024, unquote. Reading proficiency bill heads to governor. Teachers in training, young readers, would be impacted by the change. Story was written by Aaron Murphy, and the dateline is Des Moines. Young Iowa students learning to read and the college students training to teach them would be affected by legislation that was designed to improve early reading proficiency and was given final approval by state lawmakers on Wednesday. Iowa college students learning to become elementary school teachers would be assessed on their ability to teach young students how to read, and young students falling behind on their reading skills would receive extra attention and have the option of repeating a grade under the proposal. The bill needs only Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to become law. It is a streamlined version of a measure Reynolds proposed earlier this year. Quote, by investing in literacy, we are opening opportunities for our kids in the future, Reynolds said in a statement issued after the proposal was approved by lawmakers in the Iowa Senate. Quote, this bill implements evidence-based reading instruction to help students move from the critical phase of learning to read into a lifelong practice of reading to learn, unquote. It gives parents more control over their child's success by providing transparency of reading proficiency and personalized plans if students fall behind, unquote. Reynolds introduced the proposal as part of her push to improve literacy and reading instruction. The governor said during her Condition of the State address in January that although Iowa students' reading scores largely have held steady since the pandemic, the state should do more to improve those outcomes. Roughly 34% of Iowa's third graders are not reading proficiently in 2023, according to the Iowa Department of Education. Under the bill, Iowa college students learning to become elementary teachers would be required to take the nationally recognized Foundations of Reading Assessment, an exam used to determine whether an individual is equipped to teach young students how to read. The Iowa Department of Education would collect and publish the aggregate results of those assessments, showing how many students passed the test and how many did not. Reynolds's original proposal would have required all Iowa teachers to pass the test. That requirement was removed from the bill that is en route to her desk. Also under the bill, kindergarten through sixth grade students who are struggling to read would be provided with a personalized reading plan, and their parents would be notified and given the option to have their student repeat the grade. If a parent requests their student be retained, the school would be required to honor that request. Quote, the Iowa Association of School Boards is pleased to see more emphasis on early literacy and looks forward to making more progress on literacy next year by expanding access to preschool for low-income students. Emily Piper, a lobbyist for the group that represents Iowa's school boards, said in a statement to the Courier, Des Moines Bureau. The bill, House File 2618, unanimously passed the Senate on Wednesday. It previously passed the House on a vote of 92-3. Republican attorneys general attack Biden's EPA. This story comes to us from the Associated Press, and it is datelined St. Louis. Republican attorneys general are attacking the Biden administration's stated goal of pursuing environmental justice, calling it a form of racial engineering, unquote. Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody and 22 other GOP officials asked the EPA this week to stop using civil rights laws to investigate actions and policies that result in harm to Black people or other minority groups, even unintentionally, more than white residents. Quote, the EPA should be focusing on enforcing the environmental laws passed by Congress, not so-called environmental justice, which is a euphemism for Biden's extreme agenda, Moody said. Their petition demands that the EPA change decades-old rules, though the civil rights law could still be used where discrimination was intentional. The petition is unlikely to convince the Biden administration to back away from an issue EPA Administrator Michael Reagan has taken pains to highlight. Reagan, for example, went on a Journey to Justice tour to places like the industrial stretch of Louisiana, typically called Cancer Alley, to show how majority Black communities living near polluters were being hurt. To address such harms, the EPA has turned in part to a section of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 called Title VI to open investigations and pressure states to make changes. The petition in an election year is the latest in the Republicans' expanding fight against federal policies aimed at addressing historic racial discrimination, and they believe courts are on their side. They cited the recent Supreme Court decision that eliminated affirmative action in college admissions, arguing it shows the court is wary of race-conscious federal policies. Quote, because the EPA's regulations prohibit any action that results in racial disparities, a funding recipient must set demographic targets for their projects to maintain compliance, the attorneys general wrote. Quote, this kind of allocation based on group membership is a constitutional non-starter, unquote. The Florida Attorney General's office, which took the lead on the petition, said the states would sue if EPA does not amend the rules. The EPA declined to comment, citing ongoing litigation around the issue. Title VI aims to prevent discrimination in programs that receive federal funds. The agency can investigate allegations of discrimination, publish their findings, and pressure states and local governments to agree to change policies. The federal government can yank funding if they find a Title VI violation. Black Hawk County Republican leadership resigns. Replacements elected. Story written by Andy Malone. Dateline Waterloo. The Black Hawk County Republican Party elected new leadership Thursday after three of the four members of the executive committee suddenly resigned. The appointments of April Melton, owner of WCF Photography, and Jim Buschkamp, a retired marketing and media professional, as chairperson and co-chairperson, respectively, comes in the aftermath of a controversial split vote by the Central Committee that was responsible in part for two of the officers leaving. A majority of the Central Committee favored keeping the headquarters open at least until the November election. Others wanted to close the building and put those funds toward campaigns. The new leadership insists, quote, Our future is bright and feels sincere and dedicated people will lead to positive results. Quote, we've got a lot to get done in the next 200 days, Melton said, before the next party election in January. And now, listeners, we'd just like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 19th on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now let's listen to this announcement.
If you're anxious about retirement, if you can't stop worrying about your aging parents' health, if you're depressed because you feel like you're losing everyone you love, turn to Your Life Iowa. Anxiety and depression are real illnesses. Let us connect you to someone who can help, because mental health is health. Get the help you need to start feeling better at yourlifeiowa.org. We're a free helpline where you can talk, text, or chat 24/7. Brought to you by Iowa HHS.
Now, let's turn to the editorial page. Our first editorial today was printed in the Des Moines Register, written by Randy Evans. Kim Reynolds stretches words meaning with poultry summer food program. Quote, unsustainable is a fascinating word, especially when it is used in government and politics. Merriam-Webster, the dictionary folks, tell us unsustainable means something that cannot be continued or supported. But in government affairs, that definition sometimes gets changed. Instead of something being truly incapable of continuing, the word often means the person using the term simply does not want that something to go forward. Understanding this distinction can help us better parse the statements our politicians make. Here is a real-life example to illustrate this difference. Back in December, Governor Kim Reynolds ended Iowa's participation in a summer food program for low-income families with school-aged children. The governor made the decision even though the bulk of the expense would be paid by the federal government. About 240,000 Iowa children from needy families are affected by her decision. Their parents would have received $40 per month during the summer for each child who qualifies for free or reduced-priced school lunches. The program's purpose was to help these needy families feed their children during the summer when classes are not in session and the kids are not eating at school. In Iowa, the federal government offered $29 million for food assistance this summer. State government would have been responsible for covering $2 million in administrative costs. But in deciding to withdraw Iowa from the program, the governor explained her rationale. Quote, federal COVID-era cash benefit programs are not sustainable and don't provide long-term solutions for the issues impacting children and families, unquote. She also said the program, quote, does nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic, unquote. Last week, the governor unveiled details of a new state grant program to feed needy Iowa kids during the summer month. A total of $900,000 in competitive grants is being offered to communities to expand the reach of two existing summer meal programs, providing meals each weekday through schools, churches, libraries, and community organizations. It's obvious the $900,000 in state grants will not feed as many children as the $29 million in federal summertime assistance would. The money for Reynolds' proposed grants is also coming from the federal government. State Representative Chuck Eisenhart, a Dubuque Democrat, said the state meal programs Reynolds is expanding spent about $5.8 million last year and fed about 20,000 kids. The Reynolds grants will provide meals for an additional 1,800 kids, he estimated. State Senator Sarah Trone-Garriott, a West Des Moines Democrat, said in a statement last week, quote, the competitive grant program amounts to crumbs for Iowa kids. Governor Reynolds could have accepted $29 million in federal food assistance that would have reached 240,000 children in every corner of the state. The $900,000 state program she announced is tiny by comparison and forces Iowa communities to compete for a sliver of that much smaller pie. It's not enough to meet the real needs facing our state, unquote. The meal sites have inherent problems the summer food benefit cards do not. Families must bring their children to and from the meal sites every day in the summer, which is difficult for most working parents. And Eisenhardt reminded lawmakers 12 counties did not have a meal site last summer, and 21 other counties only had one summer meal site. The summer food program, which operates much like SNAP, the program formerly known as food stamps, was established during the COVID-19 pandemic when many families' incomes fell because parents had their work hours reduced or they were laid off or lost their jobs. Now, although the pandemic is not the economic impediment it once was, the earnings of many families are not keeping up with inflation. That is why the federal government is making the summer food program permanent, although it gave the states the option of dropping out. Iowa joined 12 other states in leaving the program. Nebraska first said it would drop out too, but Governor Jim Pillen, a Republican, ultimately gave in to public pressure and said Nebraska will remain in the federal program. Back to Reynolds' concerns about the federal summer food benefits being unsustainable. The $2.2 million in administrative expenses Iowa state government would have to cover to participate in the federal food program is less than it will cost Reynolds to deploy Iowa State Patrol troopers and Iowa National Guard soldiers to the Texas border with Mexico this spring. And the $29 million price tag for the summer food benefits program is significantly less than the $128 million Iowa state government is paying this year for tuition vouchers for students attending private K-12 schools. 2 years from now, when the voucher program is fully implemented, the vouchers will cost the state treasury an estimated $345 million per year. So, unsustainable really comes down to whether a government official supports or opposes that which supposedly can't be sustained. Randy Evans, the author here, is a retired journalist. Now, from Art Cullen at the Storm Lake Times Pilot, a rushed farm bill is a bad one. A 5-year farm bill was supposed to have been approved last year, but it was held up in the House over disagreements on food stamps, conservation, crop insurance, and funding. House Agriculture Committee Chair Glenn Thompson, a Republican from Pennsylvania, announced last week that he will find a way to push a farm bill out before Memorial Day in order to get President Biden to sign a new farm bill by the end of the year. Don't bet the farm on it. Senator Chuck Grassley said he is pessimistic, and so is Joni Ernst, both Republican Ag Committee members. Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican from Hull, is optimistic. Quote, "So there's going to be a lot of talk, especially when it comes to SNAP and stuff like that. But I fully believe that we will get it out of the House, and then it's just a matter of what Schumer and Stabenow is going to do in the Senate when it comes their way," Feenstra told Brownfield News. If a new farm bill can't pass this year, it is expected that another 1-year extension will be passed. Grassley said farmers would receive protection, but not adequate protection. Getting beyond an extension of the same old would be up to a new Congress, and as of now, it's anybody's guess who will be in charge. It's not as if the existing hang-ups are going anywhere. Fights over food stamps in the House stalled the last farm bill 2 years ago. House Speaker Mike Johnson walks on eggshells in his caucus room as he is accused of caving in to Democrats on spending. The same sticking points will be as sticky in 2025. It's a huge piece of legislation with terribly complicated politics. You have regional interests from the South and Midwest battling over commodity payments. you have disagreements between commodity and livestock interests. Then you throw in cultural wedge issues like food stamps, and it all becomes a mishmash. What used to be a fairly bipartisan process in the past decade has devolved into a food fight like everything else in Washington, because so few know or care about the work of the agriculture committees. Their work is controlled by the interest groups that fund our politics. If food is important, the Farm Bill should be. Our food security and agricultural resiliency are imperiled by a warming climate. A Farm Bill with conservation at its core could serve farmers and the environment better. The Farm Bill as it is, and has been over the past 40 years, has resulted in more consolidation, accelerated rural depopulation, more surface water pollution in Iowa, and fewer farmers. It also has stunted funding for research into livestock disease as pandemics build and bird flu jumps to humans. Putting a new label on a defective product does not make it better. But it might make some politicians look better if they can say they actually got some lipstick applied to the pig. Crop insurance remains intact, as does a safety net for commodity markets. Food stamps, too. As Grassley said, the protections are in place. So instead of jamming through an even worse farm bill than we already have, which is likely in this election year, we may all be better off if we take our time to do it right. Ernst should be the number three Republican in the Senate following the election, and the top woman in the caucus. She could establish herself as a national leader by stating unequivocally that nutrition programs are the most efficient way to fight poverty, which makes all of America stronger. Democrats and Republicans used to join hands over it. Hubert Humphrey and Bob Dole, Tom Harkin and Chuck Grassley. Someone needs to be a voice of reason. The ethanol industry, for example, is openly acknowledging that the future for corn growers depends on capturing tax credits for carbon dioxide pipeline. That's not a great position for Iowa farmers to be in, but that is where the current farm bill puts us. We could write a new piece of legislation that enhances soil and water health while directly paying farmers for stewardship. We can make conservation programs a lot more flexible. We can help farmers diversify their revenue streams while cleaning up the Raccoon River, which did not have a nitrate problem before farm programs encouraged planting fence row to fence row. And it could cost less if we cut corporations off the teat, which would have a lot of appeal in Iowa. That is not likely to happen by Memorial Day. More of the same is. Now from the New York Times, The Fantasy of Reviving Nuclear Energy. This was written by Stephanie Cook. World leaders are not unaware of the nuclear industry's long history of failing to deliver on its promises, or of its weakening vital signs. Yet many continue to act as if a nuclear renaissance could be around the corner, even though nuclear energy's share of global electricity generation has fallen by almost half from its high of roughly 17% in 1996. In search of that revival, representatives from more than 30 countries gathered in Brussels in March at a nuclear summit hosted by the International Atomic Energy Agency and the Belgian government. 34 nations, including the United States and China, agreed to, quote, work to fully unlock the potential of nuclear energy, including extending the lifetime of existing reactors, building new nuclear power plants, and deploying advanced reactors. Yet, even as they did so, there was an acknowledgement of the difficulty of their undertaking. Quote, nuclear technology can play an important role in the clean energy transition. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, told summit attendees. But she added that, quote, the reality today in most markets is a reality of a slow but steady decline in market share for nuclear power. The numbers underscore that downturn. Solar and wind power together began outperforming nuclear power globally in 2021, and that trend continues as nuclear staggers along. Solar alone added more than 400 gigawatts of capacity worldwide last year, two-thirds more than the previous year. That's more than the roughly 375 gigawatts of combined capacity of the world's 415 nuclear reactors, which remained relatively unchanged last year. At the same time, investments in energy storage technology is rapidly accelerating. In 2023, Bloomberg NEF reported that investors for the first time put more money into stationary energy storage than they did into nuclear. Still, the drumbeat for nuclear power has become pronounced. At the United Nations Climate Conference in Dubai in December, the Biden administration persuaded 24 countries to pledge to triple their nuclear energy capacity by 2050. Those countries included allies of the United States with troubled nuclear programs, most notably France, Britain, Japan, and South Korea, whose nuclear bureaucracies will be propped up by the declaration as well as the domestic nuclear industries they are trying to save. Quote, "We are not making the argument to anybody that this is absolutely going to be a sweeping alternative to every other energy source," John Kerry, the Biden administration climate envoy at the time, said. "But we know because the science and the reality of facts and evidence tell us that you can't get to net zero 2050 without some nuclear." That view has gained traction with energy planners in Eastern Europe who see nuclear as a means of replacing coal, and several countries, including Canada, Sweden, Britain, and France, are pushing to extend the operating lifetimes of existing nuclear plants or build new ones. Some see smaller or more advanced reactors as a means of providing electricity in remote areas or as a means of decarbonizing sectors such as heat, industry, or transportation. So far, most of this remains in the early stages, with only 3 nuclear reactors under construction in Western Europe, 2 in Britain, and 1 in France, each more than a decade behind schedule. Of the approximately 54 other reactors under construction worldwide, as of March 23rd, are in China, 7 are in India, and 3 are in Russia, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. The total is less than a quarter of the 234 reactors under construction in the peak year of 1979, although 48 of those were later suspended or abandoned. Even if you agree with Mr. Kerry's argument, and many energy experts do not, pledging to triple nuclear capacity by 2050 is a little like promising to win the lottery. For the United States, it would mean adding an additional 200 gigawatts of nuclear operating capacity, almost double what the country has ever built, to the 100 gigawatts or so that now exists, generated by more than 90 commercial reactors that have been running an average of 42 years. Globally, it would mean tripling the existing capacity built over the past 70 years in less than half the time, in addition to replacing reactors that will shut down before 2050. The Energy Department estimates the total cost of such an effort in the United States at roughly $700 billion. But David Schlechel, a director at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis, has calculated that the 2 new reactors at the Votki plant in Georgia, the only new reactors built in the United States in a generation, on average cost $21.2 million per megawatt in today's dollars, which translates to $21.2 billion per gigawatt. Using that figure as a yardstick, the cost of building 200 gigawatts of new capacity would be far higher, at least $4 trillion or $6 trillion, if you count the additional cost of replacing existing reactors as they age out. For much less money and in less time, the world can reduce greenhouse gas emissions through the use of renewables like solar, wind, hydropower, and geothermal power, and by transmitting, storing, and using electricity more efficiently. A recent analysis by the German Environmental Agency examined multiple global climate scenarios in which Paris Climate Agreement targets are met, and it found that renewable energy, quote, is the crucial and primary driver. The logic of this approach was attested to at the climate meeting in Dubai, where more than 120 countries signed a more realistic commitment to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030. There's a certain inevitability about the U.S. Energy Department's latest push for more nuclear energy. The agency's predecessor, the Atomic Energy Commission, brought us Atoms for Peace under Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s in a bid to develop the peaceful side of the atom, hoping it would gain public acceptance of an expanding arsenal of nuclear weapons while supplying electricity, quote, too cheap to meter. Fast forward 70 years, and you hear a variation on the same theme. Most notably, Ernest Monnets, the energy secretary under President Barack Obama, argues that a vibrant commercial nuclear sector is necessary to sustain U.S. influence in nuclear weapons, non-proliferation efforts, and global strategic stability. As a policy driver, this argument might explain in part why the government continues to push nuclear power as a climate solution, despite its enormous cost and lengthy delivery time. China and Russia are conspicuously absent from the list of signatories to the Dubai Pledge to triple nuclear power. Although China signed the declaration in Brussels, China's nuclear program is growing faster than that of any other country, and Russia dominates the global export market for reactors, with projects in countries new to commercial nuclear energy, such as Turkey, Egypt, and Bangladesh, as well as Iran. Pledges and declarations on a global stage allow world leaders a platform to seem to be doing something to address climate change, even if, as is the case with nuclear, they lack the financing and the infrastructure to succeed. But their support most likely means that substantial sums of money, much of it from taxpayers and ratepayers, will be wasted on perpetuating the fantasy that nuclear energy will make a difference in a meaningful time frame to slow global warming. The U.S. government is already poised to spend billions of dollars building new, small, modular, and advanced reactors and keeping aging large ones running. But two such small reactor projects based on conventional technologies have already failed, which raises the question, will future projects based on far more complex technologies be more viable? Money for such projects, provided mainly under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, could be redirected in ways that do more for the climate and do it faster, particularly if planned new nuclear projects fail to materialize. There is already enough potential generation capacity in the United States seeking access to the grid to come close to achieving President Biden's 2035 goal of a zero-carbon electricity sector, and 95% of it is solar, battery storage, and wind. But these projects face a hugely constrained transmission system, regulatory and financial roadblocks, and entrenched utility interests enough to prevent many of them from ever providing electricity, according to a report released last year by the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Even so, existing transmission capacity can be doubled by retrofitting transmission lines with advanced conductors, which would offer at least a partial way out of the gridlock for renewables. In addition to storage, localized distribution and improved management of supply and demand. What's missing are leaders willing to buck their own powerful nuclear bureaucracies and choose paths that are far cheaper, less dangerous, and quicker to deploy. Without them, we are doomed to more promises and wasteful spending by nuclear proponents who have repeatedly shown that they can talk, but they can't deliver. And a note here about the author. Stephanie Cook is a former editor of Nuclear Intelligence Weekly and the author of In Mortal Hands, A Cautionary History of the Nuclear Age. Turning now to the sports page, high school girls soccer. Cedar Falls scoring queen powers Tigers over West, I's new record. Story was written by Ethan Petrick, and it begins with a photograph showing Cedar Falls' Zoe Silstra as she dribbles the ball against Waterloo West on Thursday at the Cedar Valley Soccer Complex. On Thursday, the Tigers took a 1-0 lead early on in the game before scoring 3 goals in the final 10 minutes of the first half to take a 4-0 lead into the break. The Tigers rattled off 5 goals in the second half to clinch the runaway win and improve to a 2-3 on the season. Quote, "It's going to be another bounding board for us as we continue to build throughout the season and throughout the year," Place Thomas said. Quote, "We really want to make it to state this year, playing the tough games, but also winning the ones that we are supposed to, is how we're going to get there," unquote. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 19th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for tuning in to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.